Drive-by cinema. Three nachos and a foaming thermos of fun.
Hello and welcome. This is Drive-by cinema, season 4, episode 39. My co-host is Paul.
Hello. Hi, everybody. Welcome. And my co-host is Richard.
Hello. Paul, how are you doing? Last week, we reviewed Civil War.
We did. We said, war, what is it good for?
Absolutely nothing. Except when you're overthrowing a tyrannical government, or trying to get rid of slavery, or establishing a parliamentary democracy, then it might be justified.
Alex Garland's maybe non-think piece on this topic. I mean, essentially, what did he do but reprise We Didn't Start the Fire by Billy Joel for over 2 hours, really? Yeah. Was a general takeaway here.
I was thinking, especially with all this Trump stuff going on at the moment, which we won't go back into, but there is a debate about whether the role
Say, didn't you say Trump was trumping in the courthouse the other way? Incredible.
They don't really have that word in American slang, do they?
That's why
the headline hasn't occurred to them.
Ah.
It's like fanny packs for us, isn't it? We don't...
Sorry, go on.
No, I wanted to say, there's a sort of debate about whether the office of the president has all that much power or not. Is it a figurehead, a factotum?
Yes.
Or does it wield a great deal of executive power?
It doesn't wield any executive power, but it does wield, if you've got followers, as he had, mob power, doesn't it? And that's the only power it wields these days. I mean, Elon Musk has just as many followers on Twitter, doesn't he?
But presidents can execute executive orders and put things into practice.
In the US, yeah, I mean, he's head of the army, isn't he? That kind of stuff.
Certainly. And he holds tremendous international kind of foreign
clout.
Affair kind of power.
Yeah. He doubtless has clout, but is it executive formal power? Beyond the government itself and separate to the government itself. Could he function as a flippy floppy little limb that jumped across the table without the rest of the body politics? I don't think he could, no.
I mean, the contrary argument to the president having power is, of course, Congress and the Senate are the things that actually pass bills.
Right.
Which the president then signs into law. But if Congress and Senate won't pass it, putting forward a bill is pointless for the president. In fact, it makes him look weak, doesn't it?
Yes. Yeah. So what he can do is get in people's way.
There is a mechanism for executive orders to go through without Congress and Senate that I don't understand because I'm not into American civics and politics. And so perhaps I'm not best placed to weigh into this debate
about
presidential power. But we can look at what's happened in reality, can't we? How often is it that the president has the same party allegiance to the Congress and Senate majorities?
That's interesting. I think it's almost like 50-50. It's not a big skew. It's not like they don't align as often as you'd expect them to. Well, Congress, I mean, they only sit for 2 years at a time, don't they? They get elected every 2 years.
I did not know that.
The Senate sit forever. I don't know. It's a longer term, isn't it? So Congress is constantly changing.
I imagine that what happens is the populace tend to want to punish or have protest votes against the president after he's been in office for a while.
Yes.
So, presumably...
And politics and economics are laggy, aren't they? So, are you saying there's kind of a yo-yo effect of people pushing the swing at the wrong time, kind of thing?
I think that's where you might end up with this 50-50 Congress power
president. That's a very perspicacious analysis, yes. Yeah. I mean, I had a friend, okay, who's a Canadian PhD in politics and international relations. And 2016, when Trump got elected, lots of the Democrats, I was working in an American company, were weeping, open tears, kind of thing, when Trump got elected, yeah. And I did find it funny, I have to admit, I find it kind of funny. Because, I mean, American politics is just funny, isn't it? I mean, I never really thought that, as they were saying, he was going to try to get rid of democracy kind of thing. They were just full of dread and full of doom. And this Canadian guy was saying, well, no, I mean, he's just a part of the government. And he was saying, it is pretty likely he's going to try to do things that are anti-democratic. They just, the American government is too much of a juggernaut and too much of a road-laying vehicle. It makes the road. It lays the road that it just couldn't happen. And he was
the
right
oil tanker couldn't turn around that quickly.
Yeah. I mean, I think he was right in the end. I mean, okay, they broke into Congress and they stabbed somebody in the eye or that kind of thing. But ultimately, they made no dent on the actual process of government, did they?
Well, his attempt to overthrow the results of the election failed. And with the following wind, he may get a criminal conviction for his attempt to do that, we'll see. But what else did he do during his term in office, though? I mean, he did enact some pretty crazy, like, travel ban stuff.
He built a wall, or tried to build a wall.
It was a fence already, though, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Where it was built, and a river in other places. I don't think it's significantly altered the topology of the border. All of this speaks to the idea that he doesn't have any power. But at the same time, he did put in place several Supreme Court judges who have had real and dramatic impact on American kind of way of life.
Sure.
The overturning of Roe versus Wade, and they are on the verge of making a decision about whether presidents have immunity to, you know, any crime. I was thinking, Biden really needs to know that in the next few months, because if he's completely immune, he could do plenty of things that need to be done, couldn't he?
So, yeah, I mean, essentially, yeah, relatively without power, if he's pushing against the stream, if he's trying to swim upstream, without much power, I would say, would be the conclusion. But if he does have a party with him in both the Senate and Congress, I think the three of them together, then he gains power by being part of that. It depends on which way the wind is blowing, doesn't it, I guess? Would be my summation of all that.
Paul, do we have any other corrections and omissions? Oh, yeah, I've got a thing, by the way. Pete has given us both a present, and I need somehow to get this present to you.
Yeah, is it a gift in the German sense? It's a real present.
What does that mean? What's a gift?
A gift in German is a false friend, isn't it?
False friend.
It means not gift, it means poison.
It means like a burden of some kind.
Poison,
like
isn't it?
A plant you have to water or...
Sorry, I didn't mean to say that about Pete's gift.
No, I think it was meant in good faith. With good
intention. I'm really sorry about that. Can we edit that? That just sounds so nasty, doesn't it? This press is coming. Hooray. Well, we always welcome those.
Quite. Question
is it like a zip? Like a zippy zip for our mouths? That kind of thing.
Question is, when am I going to see you next to actually give you a present?
I think I'm about to have less work to do over the next month or two. Come June, I'll have lots of time to come and see you, Richard.
Come June. Okay. I mean, it's probably postable. I think it's small enough to post. I don't necessarily want to reveal what it is to you.
No, don't.
Point.
I love a surprise.
Fine. I will say...
God, it's not a dead shrew. Is Peter Cat? No, he's not, is he?
A dead shrew.
At the doorstep, kind of thing.
No, listen, I will say this. I think it's a thing that we're going to both need to learn how to use.
Or maybe Pete's into cat roleplay. Maybe he's a furry who likes to catch dead voles and play them at the door.
If anyone is a furry and can catch a vole, then...
Well, they're going places, I think, aren't they?
Yeah.
There's a whole section of reality TV that needs to be devoted to those kind of people.
Anyway, thank you, Pete. For me, it's a birthday present. For you, it's just an ordinary present.
Namaste.
I don't know whether that's better or worse,
Namaste.
Actually. And at that point, I think it's time to turn our attention...
Music, maestro.
...to the music. Here
What's it going to be this week? Let's find out.
Yeah, I went a little bit crazy, didn't I, last week with the music choice. I might need to apologise for it, I don't know, Paul. I made you listen to it.
I rather liked it. However, I would say it's not light and frothy, is it?
Well, I was trying to do something that fit the mood of the Civil War movie, which, let's face it, was pretty grim dark, wasn't it?
Yes.
So I came up with a blues song about war. It seemed appropriate.
It's a bit Katie Mellower, isn't it? Do you remember Katie Mellower?
I do remember Katie Mellower.
Yeah,
yes.
the thing that your mum went down the Virgin Music to buy a CD of. I was like, Mum, what are you buying CDs for? She's like, oh, it's Katie Mellower. I love her.
Anyway, enough about last week's film, Paul. What did we watch this week?
We sat through Rebel Moon Part 2, The Scargiver.
The caregiver, as
yes,
I always
the caregiver.
Read it.
I've just been saying to you, the Scargiver, it's kind of like when you're a teenager and you try to get other people to use your nickname rather than your actual name, isn't it? I think this movie kind of desperate to be liked, isn't it, in many respects?
So this is Zack Snyder, and it's obviously the sequel, the second part. Mm-hmm. I suppose a sequel is a surprise gift you get at a very popular movie's conclusion, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Whereas we always knew this second part was coming because the first part didn't really resolve the story. Yeah,
and they filmed it all at once. So, which says something about, I don't know, artistic, not integrity, but artistic sincerity, doesn't it? The whole made for streaming shelving kind of movie industry, doesn't it? Can I just say, Zack did a lot on this, directed by Zack Snyder.
Right.
Screenplay partly by
Zack Snyder.
Story fully by
Zack Snyder. Yeah.
Produced by
Zack Snyder.
Cinematography by Zack Snyder.
Good grief.
Yeah.
Busy boy. It keeps the cost down.
It's like being in Putin's Russia, isn't it, kind of thing.
Now, we observed when we reviewed Rebel Moon 1... Whatever the subtitle was called.
What was his subtitle?
I don't know.
Rebel Moon 1, the fucking shite fest, yeah.
We observed that he was doing a retread of an old story.
Called Star Wars.
The Seven Samurai.
Yes.
The Magnificent Seven. It's probably been done a dozen other times.
And with very, very strong nods towards Star Wars, would you agree?
Yes, certainly. Star Wars was the reimagining of the Hidden Fortress, wasn't it? From another piece of Japanese cinema from the... Same guy, I think he did.
Amazing, Richard. Encyclopedic knowledge of seminal and still highly watchable Japanese movie that nobody wants to watch, as you rightly said last time, because it's in black and white. But which Star Wars was there, like, destroy a Death Star kind of vibe going on?
I mean, most of them.
All of them, yeah. But there's one where they get down in that tunnel. There's a video game that came out and I played it a lot. You got to drop the bomb right in the hole, haven't you?
Well, that is the first Star Wars, Paul, yes.
That's the first one. Oh, yeah. Okay. You just keep that in mind for later on in this movie.
If you're going to tell the Seven Samurai or the Magnificent Seven story and split it over two parts, then obviously what you're going to end up with is, as we've got here, the first one where you gather all your crew together, and at the end of which there was a betrayal and a big fight, and then they actually kill the main baddie, Admiral Noble, and then
you might think,
the second one...
Well, what are we going to do now? You kill the main baddie, he's not going to come back, is he?
This is it. At the start of the second one, apart from a quick voiceover to recap everything from robot Anthony Hopkins.
Anthony Hopkins, told to act, not told to voiceover, yeah.
We're going to discover that the bad guys, I think we already knew this, I think they'd found his body. That was the end of the sort of last film's credit scene or something, wasn't it?
Oh, dear God.
But at the beginning of this one, we see that they have found his body. And one of two things is going to happen here.
Yeah.
One of two things is going to happen. Either... he's never going to fully recover. He's never going to be well enough to resume command.
But they're going to farm his thoughts for a new person to take his place. But they'll do that.
I thought we were going to have to get to know the new baddie, who is called Cassius or something, his first officer or whatever.
Right.
And why isn't it second officer? Because the first officer would be the captain. It's zero ordered, isn't it? I guess the captain is a zero.
Oh, my gosh. It's like a whole array.
So I thought we were going to have to get to know this new guy, Cassius, as our bad guy. But no, he pops out of the chrysalis that they were keeping him in, and to prove that he's fully fit and ready for command, he immediately kills his doctor.
So yeah, they don't have to download his memories and make him somebody else, or, you know, they just re-chrysalise him. And I was thinking, like, because I wasn't focusing that clearly as he was as a little chrysalis, I thought he looked a bit like Morph inside his chrysalis. Do you remember Tony Hart and Morph?
Well, just because he didn't have a full head of hair or something.
Well, you know, he was all like, he was like his little blobby shape because he was surrounded by his chrysalis, wasn't he? And then he came out all chill, wet bones and wet muscle. And it's like, oh gosh, surprise. The baddie's not dead. Well, there we go.
But fortunately, he is a few days behind because he's had to hang around in his chrysalis. And his first officer, Cassius, hadn't thought to chase after the good guys in the interim. He just hung around. Waiting to see what his commander wanted to do.
That's what you do, you know.
You might well argue, Paul, that killing off the main bad guy in film one and then just immediately bringing him back to life...
Yeah, a bit naff, potentially. Not really, no. Highly believable.
A little bit cheaty, isn't it?
Slightly cheaty.
All that effort you put into the first film kind of erased in a way.
Maybe your first film is really, really muddled, okay, and now you got hit some sluggish spot in your second film. Maybe there's not that much to do in the second film. So what would you do is maybe you do lots of backstories and try to untether.
Oh, God,
untangle,
we'll come back to that.
Untangle all the bits of knitting that are all over the place in the fucking bag. Do you know what I mean? It's like a bag full of knitting, isn't it? Honestly.
What I would say, though, the guy, Admiral Noble, and the guy who plays him, whose name I can't remember. Ed Skrein.
Oh.
Admiral Noble is quite a good bad guy, right?
In essence, yeah.
He's a bit campy, but that's what, kind of what you want in a bad guy.
We said there's this whole kind of like Gucci SS vibe going on to the Imperium, isn't there?
Balenciaga Imperium, yes. It's
Balenciaga, sorry, yeah, the Balenciaga Imperium. So it has to be a little bit cap, doesn't it?
I mean, sure. I think he's a good bad guy. I have to kind of forgive Zach for just wanting to bring him back so we don't have to get to know Cassius.
Okay.
Fine.
The other thing is, Anthony Hopkins is the voice of JC1435 Jimmy. Okay.
Jimmy, yeah.
Jimmy just cracks me up, yeah. I've never seen a robot have a bad trip of acid before. You know, like he's just like out in the woods, just like crazy wild man, isn't he?
Yeah, he's a bit of a strange robot.
I quite enjoy Jimmy. I'm warming to him quite a lot.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I loved when he was on screen. I loved it. Yeah, it reminded me of what was the creator that we saw. You know, the one all the robots and
the kid in Indonesia.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Great robot sort of special effects work. Here, mm-hmm. As in that film. Okay, so, bad guy's back, settled. The other thing that Anthony Hopkins mentions in the voiceover is that our heroes have gone back to Velt, which was where we started this whole thing. It's the moon of the gas giant, where there's a sort of Viking Amish village that just does farming. They're like artisanal farmers, aren't they?
Yeah, and just like Midsommar, yeah, they slip something in Jimmy's lemonade, don't they?
Now, they think, the good guys think, that the threat of the Dreadnought is extinguished. It's gone because Cora thinks that she's killed Admiral Noble, and she knows that when the Imperial Motherland has a commanding officer killed, the Dreadnought has to go back home for orders or something, or to get someone new assigned. That's standard procedure. So she thinks it's all cool. She doesn't know that the Admiral is back alive on board his vessel. Of course, the way that you get to the little village in Velt is that you have to park your ship somewhere in a spaceport and then get some space horses and ride them to the village. I don't know why they do that when the bad guys just land in the fields in their ships. But that's what the good guys have to do.
Well, the good guys used to have a griffin. Now they've only got horses, I notice.
Now, if you remember, at the start of the first film, a young soldier boy was left.
Changed size, didn't he?
He changed size, yeah. Because he kind of fancied the girl who was carrying water, didn't he?
That's right, yeah.
Well, now they're kind of getting along together, aren't they? But he's got to answer the telephone, the space telephone that his crew left him.
And pretend he's still on the Imperium side. Aris!
Cassius is telling him that he wants the harvest from this village in 5 days' time. So we know that the Dreadnought is coming in 5 days. Just as Cora is telling the village, oh, they won't return, we're cool, we're fine, we've done it, we killed him. Soldier Boy turns up and says, actually, they're going to be here in 5 days and they want the full harvest.
So hurriedly, well, there's a decision again, it recaps the first movie. Do we fight, should we fight, can we fight? Villagers are being convinced by the Seven Samurai to, yes, fight. So there's, hastily, either they excavate underground guerrilla tracks or they already exist, I don't know.
At this point, General Titus, who in the first movie was mostly a drunk, General Titus is actually, he actually comes out quite well in this film. He actually gives a rousing speech to the village. He tells them all that they're going to fight. He says, now I don't know how much General Titus knows about agriculture and farming, especially the way these guys do it. But he says, we've got 5 days, we're going to get the harvesting in three. One of the farmers has told him it usually takes them, I don't know, that he uses like some space term, doesn't he? Like half a season or three cycles or something. So I've got no idea whether 3 days is ages. They all seem to think, I think, that it's quite a tall order to do, don't they?
He says, get to bed early because we've got to start tomorrow instead of today, which is a strange thing to say, but there you go. I guess it's esprit de corps, isn't it?
Also, apart from doing the harvest in 3 days, I'm also going to teach you how to fight. But that'll come later. Let's first get all the food in.
And they do manage to lay some underground guerrilla tunnels, don't they? Kind of stuff.
Paul, who do you think this film is for? Who do you imagine it's target audiences?
I had cause and pause to reflect on this several times during that.
So what did you come up with?
I think we mentioned last time the lack of depth in characterization. Just these
It's played very plainly, isn't it? This whole story.
Yeah. And any point where there is introspection or soliloquy or just any statement of intent or perspective from the characters, it doesn't really stand up to examination, does it? So I was thinking this one is more cartoony than the first, I think.
So is it for kids?
I think it is for kids, yeah.
But it's quite gruesome. People get their hands chopped off, stuff like that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's definitely PG. You definitely want your parents there, and you're going to be hiding your face sometimes, probably, aren't you?
One thing I thought was the tension, although obviously constructed, I was kind of eager to see things turn out right. It might be quite a roller coaster ride for kids.
Okay, here's my next question then. We've established kids might love this film. Mm-hmm. They'll surely love the robots and the guns and the fighting and the spaceships, I'm sure. What do you think the kids are going to make about the sort of 20-minute harvesting the wheat section that we're about to get, where our heroes walk through the fields, rustling their hands through the wheat?
Okay. I was asked to commission a online learning platform for kids, right? And we had to do a biology whole section. And we kind of bookended each lesson with animated stories. And I had a very similar kind of experience to this, where I had to have people come out of a spaceship and land on a foreign planet and teach people how to plant potatoes, just like Matt Damon, but not in the rocket ship, on the terra firma of an alternative planet. And I was thinking, wait a minute, Zach's doing everything that I did for five-year-olds. They exchange gifts of thank you for fighting, and just, I think in my story, they exchange garlands of flowers and that kind of thing. And it's like, yeah, I don't know. I think five-year-olds might love it, Richard. Because I thought, well, my biology series is going to be a complete flop, but it wasn't. The five-year-olds quite like that.
Would you really show a five-year-old this film with all of the death and destruction?
Would I? Yeah, I would. Yeah.
Fine. Okay.
Because I don't think... Does it come across as particularly real, the death and destruction, or not?
There's a lot of blood and guts, Paul.
It felt very cartoony to me, this one.
Maybe, I'm right. Because, as I mentioned, these are sort of Amish Vikings, so they don't have a combine harvester. In fact, they use scythes, don't they, to cut the wheat down?
They do.
Although they do have a hover cart, a cart with no wheels that just hovers along the ground, pulled by a space horse, obviously. Strange mix. Wheels are out, but scythes are in. Yeah. Obviously, it does take everyone mucking in, including our heroes, of which, by the way, I think you would probably say there are only six, wouldn't you?
I don't know why.
Well, let's count them up, shall we?
Yeah, because one betrayed them and got killed last time, didn't he?
We've got Cora, we've got General Titus, we've got Space Derek.
We've got Gunner, who was a farmer but is now a hero.
We've got Gunner, yeah. We've got Nemesis, the witch with the swords. And finally, we've got the one whose name you probably can't remember. I think she's called Milia, who was one of the...
Yeah, I don't know her backstory and I don't care for it. I just don't know what she's doing there.
She wears cool makeup where she's got like black across her eyes, though.
So Nemesis is the interesting one. She's the Chinese witch who dresses like a Welsh witch.
Yes. So that's six. But of course, the secret seventh samurai is Robot Jimmy, isn't it?
Oh, I see.
I mean, you might argue it's the Soldier Boy as well, but there are seven of them one way or another. But they all help out, except for Robot Jimmy. They all help out doing the harvest. At the end of the harvest, they start doing their battle training. Battle training consists of getting...
I'm glad you digested this better than I did. I didn't really separate into sections like this. It was just like a boring bit of the movie.
The agricultural bit of your space movie is always the boring bit. They split into two groups, actually. One of them with General Titus, and he's showing a group of villagers how to shoot guns at mannequins that they've made.
Scarecrows,
out of straw.
Even, perhaps. Or...
And the other group have a different kind of scarecrow made out of straw.
Oh, right.
Where... Space Derek and Nemesis show a different team of people how to chop the hands and heads off the mannequins.
I was really ignoring that second part.
Now, I don't know about you, Paul, but if I was in that village and they were splitting us into two groups, I'd want to be in the group with the guns.
Yeah.
This caused me to reflect a little bit about the history of warfare and how guns changed warfare.
And the bow and arrow before it, of course.
The bow and arrow also, yeah. If you want to analyse, as some people do, military strategists and stuff, if you want to analyse who's going to win a fight, There's a sort of very simple equation you can use to do this.
Really?
It's really like playing Risk, if you remember. I think we used to play it on the Apple Macs in the college computer room, didn't we? Because it was the only thing you could play on an Apple Mac that was multiplayer. Basically, in olden times, when fighting was hand-to-hand, the equation goes roughly like this. The side with the most number of people is going to win.
Right.
And the losses are sort of proportionate to the difference in the overall sizes of each force.
With you.
It's sort of obvious if you think about it. If you stand all of your troops in one long line and run against your opponents in one long line and you each fight one person...
Shields and swords will get you somewhere, but they won't get you everywhere, will they?
Let's assume both sides have got similar levels of equipment. So eventually...
Comparable levels, yeah.
All the soldiers are going to cancel one another out.
Correct.
It doesn't mean they're going to die, necessarily, but ultimately they're going to be deadlocked. Whoever's got one extra soldier is basically going to win the fight. With firearms and range weapons, this is a force multiplier. And the reason is obvious if you think about it. If you're in hand-to-hand combat, you can only fight the people you can reach immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And that's usually one other person. Maybe if you get rid of them, maybe you can go after somebody else. But with range weapons, you can hit anyone you can see just about, broadly speaking, on the battlefield. That means that a numerical advantage is much more effective, sort of an overwhelming force multiplier. And
plus
the losses...
action at a distance, isn't it? One,
exactly.
One of you can engage at an earlier
multiple
time
targets,
and
yeah.
prevent contact occurring on a significant level with the other army.
So the losses are proportional to the square of the difference in the size of the forces, something of that order. And it's all to do with this dimensionality of conflict. This is very basic mathematics. It doesn't account for plenty of other factors. But it's certainly true that, I mean, there were two big battles in the history of English and French warfare, Crecy and Agincourt, where it was the longbow that was the force multiplier for the English, who I think were outnumbered in both cases.
Obviously, bow and arrows existed for a long time, but I think the longbow made bow and arrowmanship a very, very effective military choice, didn't it?
Yeah.
Well, the range was just so much more significant, wasn't it? 300 yards, 400 yards?
They were certainly very powerful weapons, no question. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot going on in battles, but in terms of mathematical models, it is just the case that you need a ranged weapon.
So you're questioning why Titus took half of them to learn hand-to-hand combat, is that right?
Space Derek just prefers his axes, doesn't he? I mean, there were guns knocking around. He did pick one up later, but mostly he starts off always with his axes. And Nemesis, she really likes her two sort of light swords, doesn't she?
Yeah.
They do all this training. At the end of 2 days of military training, 3 days of harvesting, they're ready. And the girl who was getting off with Soldier Boy has got a surprise for everybody because she's been spending her 5 days before the big fight
knitting
not
flags.
Doing harvesting.
Heraldic flags.
Yeah, doing embroidery. So she has a ceremony where she gives a special flag to each of the heroes. It's very nice, isn't it?
It is lovely, yeah.
But it is a huge waste of time.
Okay. So waste a bit more time, maybe, if you want to now start some backstories, yeah? Would that be something you want to do at this point, or maybe a bit later in the movie?
Well, what you might think, I suppose, is, gosh, it's a little bit like we haven't really had time to flesh out these characters that we picked up in the first movie.
Or maybe we hadn't even worked out their backstories at the start of the first movie.
Yeah, maybe we only sort of
just make it up as we go along.
Maybe he wrote that backstory at a later date. We'd best cram in all of the backstories in one sequence. Why don't we just do it?
Why don't we just do it all at once? Yeah, get it out of the way.
Get all the characters to sit down around the table.
Because it's the eve of war, isn't it? So they're feeling anxious. They're sharing a cup of mead. I guess they want to share their backstories. That would make sense. Yeah.
It's GCSE level storytelling, isn't it? It's fulfilling the brief that you were given by the teacher.
Yes.
In the least imaginative way possible.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, these backstories are unintentionally funny, aren't they, generally speaking? Cora, interestingly, tells a bit of her backstory.
With it being like a monopoly of power, I mean, surprise, surprise, they've all kind of been betrayed or betrayed the Imperium, haven't they, basically? A lot of them, anyway.
Yeah, there's no great surprises here, are there?
No.
Cora is the most interesting one. She tells a story of...
Well, we got hers last time, didn't we? We know she's something special.
Bits of it, yeah, exactly. Now she tells the story of how the king died and what happened to the princess that I think she was supposed to be looking after, right? Now, if you remember from last time, she was the adopted daughter of the regent, Belisarius. Mm-hmm. She's describing the dedication ceremony for a new dreadnought.
To which the king must turn up and say something.
Apparently, it's traditional. It's like breaking the champagne bottle on the bow of the ship kind of thing. What they do is they go down to the, I think, the boiler room, because we discover in this film that the dreadnoughts are effectively coal-powered, don't we?
Yes. We did discover that, yeah.
So we see the boiler room. It's all clean and shiny because it's not been used yet. There's all of the courtly people standing around, and the king, Belisarius, and his queen, and his daughter, the princess, are all there.
And then we get a classic moment of intergalactic Game of Thrones.
Where Belisarius, the regent, murders the king and the queen, and he tells Cora to shoot the princess.
Yes, now the princess is some sort of savant, isn't she? With magical or hypernormal powers of some sort.
In the first film, if you remember...
We see her bright light, don't we, in the first film?
She brought a bird back to life or something, didn't she? She did. She's like healing energy or something.
So she's like Greta Thunberg, but without the temper tantrums.
Now, Cora hesitates to shoot the princess, as you might.
You might, she's lovely.
But Belisarius orders her to do it. So she does. She kind of... The shot kind of explodes in a sort of golden light, but the princess...
Now, what do you call it when there's music in the movie itself that's acting as background music and music?
I was going to say that we've mentioned this word. This is diegetic, isn't it?
Well, we don't just get diegetic. We've got an orchestra playing...
It's like a string quartet, isn't it?
Oh, sorry, string quartet playing death music as they're murdered.
Yeah, they don't stop, do they? They play...
No.
Without stopping, without a break, or without looking up, really.
Can I just say, in reference to the whole movie, there's just a slurry of orchestral overture that just fills this movie, and it just fills it up to the top of the septic tank. It's just far too much orchestral music. It just never ends. When people got a revelation, like when people are going to say something significant, there's always a deep boom in the background. Oh, it's just... Oh, it's awful. I can't stand it.
Isn't it weird that the soundtracks for sci-fi movies, that musical genre was invented hundreds of years before
yes.
cinematography was invented?
It's strange, isn't it? And sci-fi, why does sci-fi go so classical? I don't know. It's strange.
We think the princess is dead, although she's almost certainly not. But right now, and for Cora's purposes, we think the princess is dead. The king
so
and queen are certainly
that's Cora's
dead.
Regretted moment, in case you were wondering. Does anybody else have any regretful moments whilst we're sharing a cup of mead? I guess they do, don't they?
No, hold on. It's important, this next bit, because during this flashback, at this point now, Belisarius immediately says, oh, it was her. He's killed the king, queen and the princess. Even while he's holding a knife to the
yeah,
dying king.
Yeah, I thought that
neck.
Was really naff, I have to say.
Yeah, I mean, clearly he must have bought the entire court off to pull that one out. Cora realises that she's got to run away at that point. Mm-hmm. And that was the beginning of her life as an outlaw, because she clearly had to flee to get out of the court before she was
Luckily,
framed.
I mean, she's crash-landed with her ship, hasn't she, nearby to the village?
That's right. She's crashed near, or on Vel, near the village. Yeah.
There we go.
That's Cora's backstory done.
We get Titus's backstory.
Titus's backstory. He defied Belisarius's orders. He was a general in the Imperium, wasn't he?
Oh, I remember now. Yes.
As a consequence, they had killed all of his men in an orbital bombardment.
And so he feels deep. That's his deep regret, isn't it? That's his regretful moment.
And he'd been drinking all through the first film, but in the second film here, he immediately stops, goes teetotal. He just pulls all of his booze away and starts drinking water. But he pretends to be still drinking from a hip flask.
They all have a laugh about that, don't they? So, oh,
they do.
He's not really drinking just before the eve of war.
Yeah, well, in fact, Space Derek, he has a bit of a sort of nudge-wink moment with him, doesn't he, about the water. They have a real bromance going on, those two.
They do, yeah.
I can see things happening. Sparks are flying between them. Space Derek's backstory is amazing.
Just for clarity, who do you mean by Space Derek?
Tarek, the guy who doesn't wear a shirt almost all the time.
Oh, right, okay. Space Derek.
Which is strange, because when we see his backstory, he's not like a barbarian from a tribal planet of jungle.
He's a nobleman.
He's a nobleman, yeah. In, like, looks like a sort of modern-day Delhi or London or something with sort of neo-Gothic architecture. And he was a prince, and of course the Imperium invaded, and his parents got killed.
So, of course, there's this kind of crypto-fascist subtext here that, of course, he's a nobleman. That's why he can bond with the animals and the griffins, yeah. And a lowly blacksmith couldn't do that. He's only a blacksmith, but actually he's a pureblood, yeah. Which is all offensive, but let's ignore it because it's a trifling move.
Oh, that's right. They have a load of griffins flying around attacking the ships, don't they, in this society. But maybe he doesn't wear shirts anymore because his clothing on his home planet was so ridiculous. Like a tweed cloak and a floppy hat or something.
It was turned up a little bit, wasn't it? I'm glad you remembered all those ridiculous backstories. So what was his moment of regret? Oh, his moment of regret was he had to watch his mother...
kill herself, actually.
Kill herself.
She threw herself from the balcony.
So they're all regretting how they've come here. Yeah. So deep.
Now, Nemesis lived in a simple fishing village, but it hadn't always been a simple fishing village.
No, there's warrior blood in her blood.
And there's a special suitcase in her hut with not only warrior blood in her blood... There's warrior hands, robot hands, and warrior swords in there. But unfortunately, to use the robot hands and the robot sword, you've got to cut your own hands off and replace them with the robot hands. So she does that. That's how she gets the superior fighting skill.
But no big regrets there, really. Apart from losing your hands.
Well, her village has been destroyed by the Imperium, Paul.
Yeah, but no regrets in terms of her actions or how it led to sacrifice on other people's part. Do you see what we're saying? You know, the previous three, we've had a general have to sacrifice his men, a noble have to sacrifice his mother, and Cora have to sacrifice the person she protected, yeah? All big regrets in terms of guilt and responsibility. Whereas she just had to chop her hands off, yeah?
It's quite gruesome, Paul, chopping her hands off. Again, I'm not sure you'd show a 5-year-old this.
Fair point. Actually, no, reconsidering my decision to let 5-year-olds watch this.
And then there's Melia, whatever the other outlaw woman is called. Again, her village got invaded. They got rescued by the Resistance. She joined the Resistance. That's pretty much it. Nothing spectacular.
Oh, so we get all the backstories. We don't just get a selection, do we?
Paul, you get one after the other, ticking them off like a checkbox.
Right. Well, I guess it's wartime, isn't it? Because, I mean, they were drinking mead and it's the eve of war, so I guess the Dreadnought's about to arrive or something like
Admiral Noble is arriving. Now, Noble is... Okay, first of all...
He's fully recovered now. He was in his, like, matrix tubes, his sustenance tubes, and now they've been plucked out the back of his spine, haven't they, so... Powerful stuff, whatever they're souping up with him.
By the way, how has General Titus arranged the defence of the village so they just won't get blown up by the Dreadnought?
Well,
this is very clever.
Like they know the Dreadnought is there to collect a bit of grain, and they may or may not need some grain, fundamentally, or maybe just viscerally, in passing, it might be benefit them to collect some grain. So he's laid the grain against the grain house and the village houses in order that if they fire on the village... they will destroy the grain that they've come to collect.
Yeah, because this intergalactic space empire...
can't feed themselves.
They don't know how to get food.
Or build warehouses, presumably, across planets. But there we go.
They have coal-powered dreadnoughts plying the galaxy that somehow they fill with coal. And we know the coal power because we see them later on, don't we? With like,
belching black smoke.
And there's guys shoveling coal into the furnaces. But for some reason, yeah, they don't know how to get grain. The only way they know to get grain is to find the most artisanal village where they don't even use mechanized agriculture and shake them down for their latest harvest. And they daren't destroy any of the grain because they need it all, apparently. This plan seems to work because Admiral Noblen and his second-in-command look at the plan of the village in their holographic bottle thing, mm-hmm. and they figure out that they've put all this grain all around the village, and they know that they can't just blow the village up, but they spot that they've put all of the women and children in the longhouse at the top of the village.
Wow.
And so he has this plan, because Noble is obviously an admiral and genius. He's going to send his special forces, who are called the Crypteria or something, I think, and they're going to capture all the women and children, hold him at knife point, effectively, and he's going to threaten the village to hand over whatever he wants. And obviously he wants the grain, but he also wants Cora, because she would be the fugitive who killed the king. He can take it back to Belisarius and be lauded for his activities. That's the plan. The villagers have moved Cora's old ship from the crash site where it landed, and they've hidden it behind a waterfall in a cave, where Cora also met robot Anthony Hopkins Jimmy, who said they were all going to die and they were doomed.
Yeah! Bit of a paranoid android at that moment, wasn't he?
Now we get the fight, the battle scene.
Okay, so essentially we've had an hour of 10 minutes of almost unredeemable sluggishness. Would you agree? So far.
It's sluggish in the sense that we get everyone's backstory and we get an agricultural sequence that nobody
sequence,
needs.
Yeah, a little montage of how to grow crops in an imaginary world. Yeah, okay. So then suddenly, if you've got 40 minutes of battle, wouldn't you say that comes across as a bit unbalanced? Like, wouldn't you have, like, crescendos and lulls, and maybe a higher crescendo at the end, but maybe you want a taste of what's to come earlier on in the movie?
I'll give Zack Snyder credit, Paul. I think he does the action sequences pretty well.
I was going to say, what you would imagine to be unredeemable sluggishness. However, I do think he managed to redeem himself somewhat, mostly, maybe completely, with the last 40 minutes.
Well, for a start, Cora gives herself a haircut. She goes back to like her imperial buzz cut, and she looks pretty damn good, honestly, in that haircut. And she strides out to meet Noble, and he says, "Listen, I'll spare the village if you surrender, and I'll take you back." She's very tempted by this because she doesn't want to see the village destroyed in a huge fight. Initially, she is going to agree to this, but her mate Gunner, by the way, Gunner and Cora have
shagged. Well, she's fallen in with the top Amish guy, isn't she? So, I mean, it's going to be hard for her to say goodbye to him.
That's right. They've actually made love, haven't they? Amish love has occurred during the during the agricultural sequences. But Gunner won't have any of it. He's definite that they're going to fight. So when she goes back to kiss him goodbye, he steals her pistol and he shoots the bell, which is the signal for them to all start fighting.
Sabotage.
And the first thing that happens is General Titus has got prepared trenches. Somehow they've managed to build an extensive tunnel and trench network.
Amazing. Just like Vietnam, like
on the battlefield.
Incredible.
Some guy pops out of it with a rocket launcher, shoots into Admiral Noble's dropship, which has got its hangar door open kind of thing, which blows up.
And takes out another dropship next to it, I think. I think there's two taken.
Yeah, the shockwave knocks a load of people over, and it's total chaos. And even, I think, Noble's knocked over as well. It all goes off at this point.
Okay, there are some fabulous explosions here, and there's so much shrapnel heading people's way, and people are dying for cover. I thought this is a great scene, generally.
Now, Nemesis has got the job of looking after the women and children, and she's seen one of the ships peel away. She knows what's coming, so she's prepped and ready. So when these Special Forces guys arrive at the Longhouse...
Why couldn't they just burn the Longhouse down?
Because of the grain, Paul. Because of the grain.
Oh, they really want the grain.
They really want the grain.
Okay.
Yeah, it's essential. And Nemesis, along with the soldier boy who's up there as well, and I think the others have got guns, but they're all obviously not necessarily the best at them. And she fights with all of these cryptaria, or whatever they're called. She's mostly holding them off. Noble's plan isn't working up there. But Noble has sent down loads and loads of troops, hasn't he? And they are advancing on the village. Of course, General Titus...
With tank crawlers? I don't know what you call these machines that are crawling along.
The tanks come a bit later, yeah, but initially it's just they flood infantry over the bridge. Titus bursts out of a barn with all of the guards with guns, the lucky crew, and Space Derek jumped out with all the farmers with farming implements.
Not so lucky.
And shotguns and stuff.
There's a constant focus on the oldest guy on the team, the farmer with the longest beard. Who gets shot but then seems to be okay at the end of the movie. Plot spoiler.
There's a villager who looks a little bit like Wolverine, isn't there? Who he goes and fights Noble as he tries to get out of the dropship.
Oh, he's a villager.
Right. One of the villagers, yeah. And he has a fight with Noble and nearly does him a mischief, but I think he gets knocked out of the dropship as it's flying away. Nemesis eventually gets one of her hands cut off and ends up stabbed.
What a cruel twist of fate. She chopped her hands off and now she's lost her electronic hands.
But there's a little blonde boy who took a bit of a shine to Nemesis, wasn't there?
Yeah, earlier tickled her with an ear of corn previously, or an ear of wheat.
I thought he was possibly a bit young for her, but who knows. He goes and stabs the guy who's just about to kill Nemesis, doesn't he, with a sort of pocket knife. they manage to kind of win in the longhouse there, don't they? Because the soldier boy is there as well.
But not without Nemesis losing her life, yeah?
Nemesis does die, yeah.
Right, so we know this ain't Hollywood. This is following either a Japanese or Korean tradition of, or Greek tradition of tragedy, isn't it? Heroes will die. Amazing.
Our best bromance buddies, Space Derek and General Titus, they win on the bridge. They fight back, sort of destroy all the
infantry. Is it Pyrrhic or not? I guess we're going to find out in a second.
But as the smoke clears, as you mentioned, these tanks start coming. They're not normal tanks. They're obviously
walking
tanks.
No, they're a fucking mess on them. Let's face facts.
It's space tanks, isn't it? These tanks start coming.
Imagine a Trabant reimagined as a tank. They're kind of like that, aren't they?
Meanwhile, clever thing is happening. Cora and Gunner have gone to the waterfall, jumped in Cora's old dropship.
There's a surprise.
What they're going to do is they're going to fly with all of the other dropships that are going back to the Dreadnought, including Admiral Noble's.
Yeah, why are they beating a retreat?
Well, the first wave of infantry failed. They sent the tanks in.
Was there a massive booby trap as well?
There was a big booby trap, yeah. They'd set a load
of
explosions.
Which I enjoyed.
Up.
Okay, I thought
great
all of that...
explosions, yeah.
I thought the hand-to-hand arm fighting and later on, like, the battle with ships, I think it was all very, very well done. And there was real tension here. It's like, because there were several threads, weren't there?
Yeah. Like, yeah. And it's actually a good tactic Cora is using here. They sneak back on board, or they sneak on board the Dreadnought by pretending to be one of the dropships. In fact, a damaged dropship. And they get sort of taken on board. They send a medical team and they pretend that they're injured or dying, don't they, on board the ship. They've dressed
up. What she's going to do, she's going to lay some depth charges or something.
She's got a bag of explosives with her.
Oh,
yeah.
Right, explosives.
But they,
yeah.
the medic team arrives. Put
but
them
I guess
in a
she'll
lift.
Need amazing ninja skills to work her way through the ship. What is she, Richard, to get to the heart of it and lay those explosives?
And obviously, they kill the medics as they're being.
That's okay.
To.
They're medics, easy. Yeah.
Yeah, not a walk around. And then she crawls through. She crawls through what in Star Trek would be called Jeffrey's tubes, but this, right. It just means. The maintenance areas of the ship to get to the engine room. And the engine room is a big room.
It's coal powered, isn't it?
Below it is coal powered furnaces, but then above it is like a statue of a face with glowing eyes and loads of light coming out of its hair, which is crazy. It's called the King's Gaze, this ship, isn't it? So maybe that's something to do with it. But anyway, she goes up there, she puts loads of explosives on this sort of power core that's coal powered or whatever, and she's told Gunner to go back and get the ship started. But Noble, meanwhile, well, he's worked out from reports that Cora is on board the Dreadnought, and now he's changed his priorities.
Well,
totally.
She's up here. The reason he didn't really want to do anything down below was he wanted to take her back alive and become the hero who captured the Scargiver, as he calls her. But now she's up here, he can just destroy the village, can't he?
So he orders an orbital bombardment, and these huge cannons start turning on the village, which is very Star Wars-y, as you say. We now know he's going to try and blow up the village if he can. Cora has placed the explosives and he's trying to run away.
Okay, all this tension worked quite well. She's got to do several things. There's a timeline, okay. I like the fact it's not a direct kind of like bomb countdown thing where she's got to defuse something in time. He's got his set of events. She's got her set of events. It's who's going to get there first, yeah. I like the tension that he sets up here. I thought this was quite energetic and quite engaging.
And down in the village, it's also still thrilling because the tanks have arrived, but our outlaw girl, Milia, has popped up. She blows up one of the tanks with some heavy weaponry and sort of runs into the crater and starts attacking all the soldiers. Turret goes to rescue her and picks up a gun, I think, for the first time. And I guess General Titus probably goes along with him. But there's another tank coming, and just as you think it's all over for them, Robot James arrives, Anthony Hopkins arrives, totally destroys the tank, doesn't he? He gets shot at by a load of guys, but he shoots them all with his gun, like a robot would, and then he jumps into the tank, pulls a grenade off one of the tank operators, drops it in there and jumps out and blows the tank up. It's amazing.
It is really amazing, cool. Yeah.
Because he's a pacifist normally, isn't he, the robot?
Yeah, and he talks like C-3PO, so you wouldn't really expect it. He's like, you know, he's like a rice burner car, isn't he?
But the Dreadnought's guns are turning towards the village now, and you can see the guys operating it, looking at the village through the scope. Suddenly, the bombs go off at the core of the ship.
Luckily.
The whole ship.
Yeah, it lists to one side, doesn't it? And therefore, they miss.
The shot goes wide. Yeah, it goes over the village, in fact. blows up an enormous explosion sort of in the mountains behind the
village. So now we get a deeply entertaining sequence of essentially Titanic in the sky, where the ship kind of lifts on one side, it's ballast, it's aeronautic ballast is shot to shit, and it's kind of falling under gravity to the ground,
On the hangar deck, Cora and Noble have a big fight on this tilting thing. So they keep falling down, don't they, as it's sliding.
Because it was so active, I can kind of ignore the fact that I've just found it really difficult to accept that she'd be able to find her way back to her little ship whilst free-falling under gravity. and fighting somebody and clinging on to, like, ledges. I just
it
found all that.
It's a great sequence, though, Paul.
But it is such a good sequence. I can forgive all of that completely.
Finally, she winds up struggling with him. They wind up in a position where he's strangling her. Do you think it's all over for her? She seems to be losing. But Gunnar, of course, runs up and shoves a laser sword through him.
Yeah, it's a bit of a shit shot, though. He tries to shoot the Admiral. Is it Admiral or General?
No, he shot the other guy that was with him. He shot.
Successfully?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so he's getting better at the war thing.
Then they trap him in a door, and Cora chops Noble's head off.
So he must be dead this time.
Sure. And they manage to fly out of the hangar and crash land near the village, don't they?
Somewhat incredibly, yeah.
Just as they do that, the resistance fighters, the Blood Axes, come flying in their fighters to shoot all of the
Why didn't they turn up earlier?
The traffic pool couldn't get there. They probably had to leave their ships at the space
station. Crikey. And then it's all over, isn't it?
But Gunnar took a shot, didn't he? I think Noble shot him whilst he was...
Yeah, what's our KD count here? Well, they've killed an entire dreadnought and all the soldiers on board. But who's taken a hit? We've got Welsh-Chinese Nemesis, the witch's hat, the flat witch's hat. And is it Gunnar?
Gunnar is dead, yeah. He dies in Cora's arms.
Just two? Is that all? Is that
just
body
two?
Count?
Yeah.
Okay. And then there were five.
At the funeral, Cora admits to the rest of the heroes that she's the adopted daughter of Belisarius, because she hadn't told them that. And the assassin
of
the princess.
Not? We were privy to that information. They weren't. Wow.
That's right. That's right. She is regretting killing the princess and understands if they all hate her. But Titus says, oh, the princess is still alive.
Yeah, I'm Morpheus and she's like something in our rebel alliance that nobody knows about. Amazing. Gosh.
And what's more, perhaps even more terrifyingly, they're all willing to stand by her and fight in another movie or maybe more.
Yeah, maybe six, actually, if you read Wikipedia. Maybe six in total. Ow. Right. Okay. There we go. Okay. Let's compare it to Dennis Villeneuve. Do I make another one? I'm going to take a year to decide. No. Over here with Zach. He's doing all six, whether or not we want them. So I presume he's written them already.
Yeah. I'm sure he's got it all finely plotted. Yeah.
So as you say, Richard, the back end of it, fairly stunning battle sequences, really, really engaging action. Was it enough to redeem the whole movie? I guess that's what we're here to decide. Shall we score it first and then decide?
Okay. Well, yeah, let's score it. Let's do acting then.
Yeah. I mean,
look, I don't think there's anything wrong with the acting.
Not wooden, but certainly two-dimensional is what I was going to say. But then...
Well, that's the characters they were given. Yeah. I think they were bought into it. You know, no one in the cast really felt like they weren't on board, except maybe Space Derek. I think he felt it might all have been a
and
bit
And then silly. All gone to the extent of, like, getting cyberpunk haircuts or, like, rainbow glitter on their faces to really buy into that alternative Amish Viking vibe, hadn't they? Yeah.
So, for acting, I've got to give it a 7. I think it's all...
I would say perfunctory, but it's a bit more than perfunctory, isn't it? It's enthusiastic.
Yeah, they're on board, yeah.
Enthusiastically two-dimensional, unfortunately. For me, it's a 6.
Okay. Plot. We need to talk about plot, don't we?
Yeah, we do. A bag of knitting, just what? What on earth? Like so many pointless backstories that are irrelevant to the action of the movie.
He needs a better writer, Zach, doesn't he? He's a good filmmaker. Look, he knows his visuals. He knows how to do an action sequence. No,
they're not just good visuals. They're deeply popular visuals, aren't they, the way he does it? Like,
it's exceptionally good. Yeah. It's a really good-looking movie in a lot of ways. I mean, maybe we'll come to a bit more of this in another category.
I'm going to give the plot 4. I'm sorry.
He cannot do the plot. All right. It's a very straight-down-the-line interpretation of an old story. He's not trying to
Which
do
Kurosawa
too much
movie is this one, Richard?
Seven Samurai.
Is this Seven Samurai? What, this installment or this?
Well, yeah, this is Defend the Village moment. It's the real deal.
It is, isn't it? Okay. But what was the first one then?
It was Seven Samurai.
Oh,
but
all right, okay.
Slowly.
Slowly, right. Okay. I mean, the point is, I mean, I like linear narratives, okay, in an action movie. Why not? Provided you've seeded it with enough tension and enough credibility. And I thought generally he almost succeeded in doing that. But it was just the unfathomable lack of action in the first half.
The stakes aren't right. The stakes aren't right. Why do the Imperium want the grain?
Yeah, and all that. It was just a hokum, wasn't it, basically?
The agricultural sequence, the bringing the harvest in 3 days. That's tension nobody cares or wants.
It's worse than a sandworm, isn't it, in terms of world building? Like, it's
much worse than a sandworm.
Like, it's like playing SimCity and being able to take the taxation rate up to 85% and still win kind of stuff, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, it's just, it doesn't work as an imagined universe. So 4 for me. How did you score the plot, Rich?
Yeah, I think 4 is fair. Ooh. It's below average.
Yeah.
Let's do action and special effects and visuals, everything about it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not the person to dig into this in detail, but I just, as a viewer, it was deeply captivating. The use of the detail in the shrapnel and when the wooden huts exploded, just fabulous detail of the CGI. I love the lightsaber kind of effects and the swish of all that kind of neon. Although highly unbelievable, like the fight during Freefall was just amazing. Okay,
spectacle, total spectacle. Yeah.
Yeah. So for me, I've got to score it a 9 on that category alone.
You know, I've already said Zack Snyder's got an incredible visual eye.
Mm.
It is a spectacular masterpiece. One thing that's really important about what he does, and it's true of all of the films I've seen of his, is all of the action is really well motivated, and you can follow it and there might be quick cuts, but you understand what's going on.
It is deeply followable, yeah.
So many like modern action films are just cut, intercut, too close. You can't really see what's going on. Oh, somebody's won. And it's a good guy, probably. Fine. But, you know, you couldn't follow the action. And it's action for action's sake. It's not motivated by the characters and by the story. Zack Snyder doesn't make those mistakes. He does really clear action sequences, not only at a tactical level, but also at a strategic level.
I thought that worked in this movie, yeah.
He even took the time to explain what the bad guys were doing, the strategy they were doing. Now, it might have been bonkers, but I don't know why they cared so much about the grain they wouldn't have shot. As you say, probably more likely they didn't want to kill Cora. That's perhaps more believable. But they explained it, and you knew what they were doing. You knew exactly why each bit was there. It's really good. It's really good. If you'd been given a good story to tell...
The action had narrative sincerity.
Exactly, yeah. He's brilliant at that. The visual... I also want to talk about the visuals. There's several sequences. As you mentioned, robot Anthony Hopkins, Jimmy, goes a bit loopy, doesn't he? Because he was like a pacifist in the first movie. He ends up killing somebody.
He just went
upgrade.
He needs to drop a few tabs and just work it all out, man. I'm not saying he didn't decapitate bears and wear their skins. We don't see that bit of Jimmy's psychonaut journey, but there we go.
Through this movie and the last movie, we see him like wearing antlers, don't we?
We do.
It's a big feature.
He's batshit crazy, Jimmy, yeah.
And you get these scenes where you see robot Jimmy with antlers on and a sort of tattered cloak flowing in the wind.
I would have liked to be in silhouette practicing kung fu on a cliff under the moonlight whilst you're wearing the
antlers.
Well,
you basically get similar images. All of those bits with the robot with antlers looking out looked like the cover of sci-fi books, particularly 60s.
They did, books. They were very reminiscent. Or those maybe computer paintings. Mags from the 80s.
The visual of that was brilliant, and it's like an image you already know just looking at it.
Correct.
And it feels comfortably familiar for some reason.
He does. He taps into some sort of image popularity zeitgeist, doesn't he?
It's brilliant. It's brilliant. Mm. On the other hand, counterpoint that, all of these spaceships are these like blobby amorphous things.
Did you not like the coal-powered technology, Richard? Vaguely affecting. I thought it was a nice try. It's not steampunk, is it? It's coal-punk.
The coal fire aspect is very Warhammer 40,000. I don't
is
have
it?
A problem
oh,
with
right.
that. Okay. What I would say, though, is none of the ships really could you imagine like a kid wanting to get a little toy.
True.
Think about Star Wars. Think about the X-Wing and the TIE fighters. Wow. They're all immediately recognizable.
So you're saying the battle scenes and the action, it just ties into what the audience wants sympathetically. But the technology doesn't. Yeah, that's a fair point.
The production design, the production art of the design of the ships particularly, but also of the bad guys.
They were like guppies. They were like little tropical fish, but without nice colours, weren't they?
We had a dreadnought. We had those dropships. I think there may have been a couple of types of dropship because some of them belched black smoke.
And they're all as aerodynamic as Mr. Blobby, weren't they? Yeah,
and there were the tanks as well. They're all like these bulbous, blobby things with no definition. You couldn't describe them. I'd have trouble describing them now. And the Blood Axes have got slightly better ships later. But even so, they're still a bit nondescript. And then the bad guys, like all the infantry, wear this kind of armour, which is patterned with sort of DPM. It's kind of grey and beige. And
correct, yeah.
Again, compare it to Star Wars.
It is a bit MTV Unplugged, isn't it? Yeah, it's a bit acoustic guitar-y, yeah.
It's a bit Starship Troopers, but Starship Troopers did it better again.
They did, yeah.
That's the only failing visually, I think, of this vision, is the ships and the production art, the production design of the film didn't quite come up. So after that long speech, for the visuals and stuff, I'll give it an 8. And I'm dinging it just because of that fact.
Right, we couldn't score any more categories. I think 3's enough, isn't it?
It's exceptional work. All right, so overall, Paul.
Overall, I'm looking at my scores, and I think it does redeem itself strangely. It got panned by the critics really unfairly, I think. It's not as bad as the critics make out, okay? There's one guy who's sort of come over to the side of saying it does redeem itself and giving it 2.5 out of 4 stars. But they're few and far between positive reviews. Generally, everybody's ganged up against this movie. I don't think that's fair. I think it makes it over the mark. I'm going to score it a 6.5.
I'm going to give it a 6 as well, maybe a 7. It's just a bit of fun, right? It's just
fun. Yeah.
If you take it too seriously, you are going to find the flaws.
It's not a turkey, which is what they made it out to be, and it's not. It's a really enjoyable movie.
He's a great filmmaker. He's not a great writer.
If you're prepared to sort of forestall your enjoyment for an hour, because it's really turgid at the beginning. But the great thing about that hour is you can just ignore it. It's not necessary to get the movie, is it?
You don't need to focus for a
for a long time.
For a while, until the fight starts, then you really want to.
Maybe he knows how we watch Netflix as opposed to going to the movies. Maybe
we're all double screening, aren't we?
Yeah. You know?
And then we get just enough adrenaline to
25 minutes of focus,
shake us out of the sofa and go and do something.
Sure. I recommend, good fun. And certainly, I think the kids, it will go down a treat on Netflix with the kids. So,
Watch the first one, you're going to have to watch this one, aren't you?
Yeah.
Because this seals the deal for the first one.
And there's 4 more to come, so lots to look forward to.
Well, I was going to say, do we want 4 more? I don't know.
Well, we're going to get 4 more.
He's going to be going off the script of the Seven Samurai now into maybe his own imagination.
Okay.
I don't know. That could be a good or a bad thing. But
could be.
Yeah. What shall we do next week?
I think we've already decided, haven't we? It's going to be Oculus.
Surely.
Chosen by us. Yeah.
I've already watched it, so I'm ready for it.
Because I haven't seen it just yet.
So you get yourself in
front of it. Is it on Prime or is it on Netflix? Or is it on Canal Plus, Richard?
I had to rent it, so I watched it on Google Play.
Googly, here I come. Brilliant. So do join us next time for episode 40.
40, yes.
Series 4, Drive by 7.
Until the next time, thank you for listening. Goodbye.
Ciao for now. See you in the next one. Bye.